Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software geeks in Western Russia who provide iOS and Android for mobile, machine-to-machine, and embedded software engineering. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
It is Saturday, January 18th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it is time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the minis and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch in the host chair today, and with me in the studio is, first of all, operating the board, our fearless leader and producer of the show, Mr. Lyle Troxell, and on the air, Ben Jaffe, a technology teacher, musician, and web developer.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ben. And today we're welcoming back from his hiatus, Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
Hello, Miles. How are you doing? Welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here. I'm glad that my daughter has gotten old enough where she isn't quite so demanding.
Nice. She's letting you be on the air today is what I'm hearing.
Basically.
Very gracious of her. Now, Ben, I did want to start with you. You had a couple of stories that we wanted to cover right off the top. These are things that have been covered in the news here and there, but it's, you know, worth kind of taking a look at from a geeky perspective. What's going on?
Definitely. Well, there's a wonderful article about the Target point of sale malware. Everyone's heard, probably many people, most people have heard about the Target attacks and how credit card information and all that stuff was stolen. Well, it was actually a piece of malware at the point of sale registers that collected all that information. And that information was shipped off to somewhere in Russia. Oh. We don't know where, some server. So anyway, but there's a great article talking a little bit more about the actual malware and how it works and all of that stuff. So if you're interested in that, we'll put a link up to that on our website. Yeah. Also, Google is acquiring Nest.
This is the home automation thing. I've seen people, they have like the, you know, control the temperature, control the lights.
Yeah, yeah. It says Nest's mission is to reinvent unloved but important devices in the home, like thermostats and smoke alarms.
Oh, that's adorable. So, they make it sound so friendly.
I know. So, but we were joking before the show, like what's next? So Google's already acquired Boston Dynamics, which makes those creepy robots.
The robots that can scramble up hills.
Yeah, and now we've got the home automation system. Right. Like what if our homes just walk away sometime?
Exactly.
Someday?
Be careful, everyone. The singularity is coming.
And then also on a previous episode of Geek Speak, we covered a story where with the whole Silk Road website drug bust thing, the U.S. found itself in possession of about $30 million of bitcoins.
Oh, right. What's going on with those bitcoins?
And we were saying, like, what is the U.S. government going to use that? So I did a little bit of looking, and there's also a recent story about it saying that when the U.S. government seizes funds from raids like this, they end up using them just for general spending. But what about bitcoins? Well, the U.S. government doesn't have enough imagination to use the bitcoins as bitcoins, apparently. So they're just going to convert them to cash.
Miles got something to say about that.
Go for it,
Miles.
What do you know about this, Miles?
They were talking about their goal is to convert the bitcoins to U.S. dollars. Unfortunately, this is a large number of bitcoins.
Yeah.
So there aren't any. Yeah, there aren't any bitcoin exchanges on the internet that could handle transactions that large.
To launder their
own
bitcoins.
There actually has been some interesting commentary from all sides, conjecture with regard to the government and their feelings toward bitcoins. You have some that have been neutral, and you have others that are saying, like, not so sure about this bitcoin thing. You shouldn't have a separate currency. And so I have a little bit of a worry that it could be used as a financial weapon to kill Bitcoin.
Oh.
If you have a huge amount that you can crash a market, you can actually reduce faith in that currency. And that's the only place where currency gets a value is that people have faith in it.
I'm happy for your tin hat, Miles. That is something that did not even occur to me as a possibility. I was thinking, geez, they should use it to bust nefarious types who are using Bitcoin to avoid being detected as having financial transactions.
Let's say they won't use it as a scalpel, like you were talking about. But yeah. I guess I worry about that hammer. And the fact that the hammer is available now is, should give you some pause.
Add it to the list of things to have pause about.
Just to give this a little bit of context, if the U.S. government were to sell 3,000 bitcoins right now, the price of bitcoin would go from the current 807 on Bitstamp to 730 if they sold it all on Bitstamp. Right. Now, of course, the U.S. government has a lot more bitcoins than that. Not 3,000, it has 30,000. So exactly. That's a really good point, Miles.
Wow. So interesting discussion. And people can find out more about it right now at our website, geekspeak.org. We are live updating as we go along. By the way, feel free to contact us also either at geeks@geekspeak.org if you're on the emails or if you're on the telephones, 800-655-5877. Rick Philman is happy to take your calls. And we'd love to know what you think as we talk about all the things. Miles, what's going on with Microsoft and updates? I heard XP was on the way out, but...
XP was scheduled to be end of life, no more security updates, I believe in April of this year. Mm-hmm. And much to the chagrin of security folks and computer folks in general, the developers, Microsoft is giving XP a reprieve until July of 2015. Uh-huh. And I am shaking my fist right now in the sky over this one.
What? You can't wait for it to die, is what I'm hearing.
I really can't. It's
Yeah, we've been waiting for this day for so long. Like, when is it going to be 2014? When is XP going to finally go away?
Yeah. Right. And for me as a web developer, what XP means really is that people are still on Internet Explorer 8 and below.
Yeah.
And once you kill that, then it becomes a...
It's fewer things that you have to take care of to make sure they work in those other platforms.
Right. It also means that I have more tools in my tool chest that I can... The toolbox that I can use to bring to bear.
Okay.
But it's also... there was an issue where in April, when XP ended support, that we... A lot of us were expecting there was going to be a huge spike in malware that... A lot of malware authors were expecting, like, okay, that date comes, and then go. You know? So I
and
know that they're going to
attack all the computers that are no longer going to be updated.
Right, and when they did have a security exploit, that's it. They were just going to have a security exploit. There was no fixes going to be made for it, no antivirus updates.
So is this reprieve in part about making sure that that doesn't happen?
It's questionable, but at the same time, I think it also had to do with the number of enterprise customers that Microsoft has that are very slow moving and just dropping support for people who are paying you is sometimes difficult.
Difficult and a little rude.
Yeah, as a fun fact that goes along with this, just so you know, 95% of the world's ATMs are running XP.
Oh boy.
An embedded XP.
Are you serious?
So it's a slightly different variation of it, but yeah.
So get your cash out now. I guess that's...
And that one's...
Bitcoins, guys.
And Embedded XP ends its life support January 2016.
Okay. All right. Well, stay tuned, everybody, and maybe switch to something else.
And this is no reason for you to keep using XP. Keep pretending that it's April.
Yeah.
And just... Seriously, Windows 7 is awesome compared to it.
Yeah.
Anything.
Windows 8 is as good as XP. Okay. Windows 7 would be better.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right. Good recommendations from Miles. Now, Ben, why is Mozilla paying attention to where the cell towers are?
I'm glad we're going there because that story left a really bad taste in my mouth.
We need a Mozilla unicorn chaser.
Yeah. Okay. So this is kind of a short but really fun story. Mozilla is building a map of all of the publicly observable cell towers and Wi-Fi access points. Now, the reason they're doing this is because if I pull out my Android device and I turn on, let's say I open up the Maps application, it'll try and do a couple things. First of all, it'll try and turn on GPS and figure out where I am based on GPS. But if it doesn't get GPS service, it will also look around me at the Wi-Fi access points and the cell towers. And from the cell towers and Wi-Fi access points that I'm closest to, it can deduce and triangulate my position. So that's one way of figuring out where a user, where a device is in the world.
And we have to do that because GPS, like for example, if you have an iPhone, and I don't know if the performance has gotten any better, but it would take anywhere between 45 seconds and 2 minutes for the GPS chip to actually lock into your position.
Okay.
Every time you look in at your phone to look at the map and it pinpoints where you are, mm-hmm. that's because of cell towers.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's actually another thing to it as well. There's not just GPS. There's also this thing called assisted GPS, where it'll download the information that it normally would get from the GPS towers through the internet, through 3G or through your Wi-Fi or something like that, mm-hmm. to try and lock on faster. But still, it takes a decent amount of time to get that GPS chip up and running properly.
Yeah.
So that's all well and good, locking onto Wi-Fi access points and everything, but who owns that data? Who owns the list of public Wi-Fi access points and cell towers?
So there's an advantage to Mozilla having that information.
Yeah, right now I think there are a number of private companies that have it. Google obviously has their own. They have an advantage because they were driving around with their Street View cars, and their Street View cars were looking around and saying, okay, well, where are the Wi-Fi access points? And mapping all of that as they drove around and took pictures. So that was advantageous for them.
It does seem like Google's mission could be documenting all of the things.
Yeah. I guess their mission is don't be evil.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But so Mozilla does not have Street View cars to drive around. So they want to build a map of these cell towers and access points and everything. And then they'll be able to use that without either paying any services for that right or privilege or any of that stuff. Of course, mm-hmm. this is something that we as consumers don't pay for. The companies either invest in building their own or pay for access to something like
and
that.
And is there a net benefit to consumers?
I think so. I mean, if you have more open standards and data sources and things like that and maps, one of them, darn it, I'm blanking on the name, the... mapping surface that's open?
OpenStreetMap.
OpenStreetMap. Yeah, exactly.
So the one with the incredibly obvious name, OpenStreetMap.
Easy to search on.
Yeah, so anyway, I mean that's really important as well, too, because if you don't have money and you want to build a mapping service, or if you're a nonprofit and you want to build a mapping service that's free for people to use, you want to have map tiles, you can serve them. But that data is really expensive. So that's why things like OpenStreetMap exist, and also why Mozilla is mapping this. Now, as I mentioned, they don't have a car that's driving around all the time that's getting all this information. So you can, if you want to help them out, download an app called Moz Stumbler, and we'll put the link up on the website. And if you let that run while you're walking or driving around, it'll actually map roughly and triangulate where the Wi-Fi access points are and all that stuff. Mm. It's kind of interesting. Your phone is figuring out where the Wi-Fi access points and the cell towers are, so that way later it can figure out where it is based on that data. So in a way, it's kind of in a way of giving back, right? So I like that idea.
Right, and to counteract the creepy aspects of it, this is no different than any other map application you're using out mm-hmm. there.
It's
they
already
all
out there.
Have had to do this.
Okay.
So, yeah,
all right.
That's
so
true.
So Mozilla's just jumping in.
Yeah, this is nothing new.
Got it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Geek Speak. The geeks today are Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. And coming up, Miles is going to talk about the federal court killing net neutrality and what the FCC will be doing about that. But first, let's have a little bit of a break. And this is Geek Speak here on Central Coast Public Radio, 88.9 KUSP. It is just one of many fine shows here at the station. You could also tune into the 7th Avenue Project tomorrow at noon. That's when it airs. For the last 35 years, Rick Walker has been creating and performing a huge range of music, from new wave to goth, punk, and jazz, and from African-style percussion to electronica and looping. As he continues his relentless exploration of the sonic universe, Rick takes a moment to look back on his musical journey with KUSP's Robert Polly, a very fine interviewer, by the way, and you can hear that on the next 7th Avenue Project, Sunday at high noon on 88.9 KUSP. So, Miles, I let it slip that you wanted to talk about net neutrality, so why don't we do that? It looks like it took a fatal blow.
Well, a federal court struck down the the rules that the FCC had put forth about net neutrality. Net neutrality being, for some background, forbidding an ISP from charging the company that's trying to deliver content to you in a preferential manner.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, that would be like, I have paid the ISP to give me internet access.
Mm-hmm.
And Netflix has paid their internet provider for access, or internet providers, as the case may be.
Right.
And then, but the ISP is not allowed to say, okay, well, we're going to give traffic to this other Netflix competitor because they're paying us make sure that they have better traffic.
They were not able to do that. But it's that by taking away net neutrality, doesn't that mean it's like before everyone had the same access to...
Well, legally mandated same access.
Yeah.
Now, it was a little bit... it wasn't exactly like that because you still had deals that Netflix and Google and Yahoo and others have put forth, which is they've gone to different ISPs and said, hey, if you just give us some rack space, we will put our own caching servers in your network to speed up things for your customers.
Okay.
So they have provided that, but there couldn't be a deal where the traffic just leaving the network of an ISP mm-hmm. would preferentially choose one vendor over another.
Mm-hmm.
That was struck down by a federal court.
Just this week.
Yes. However, that court decision did not say that there were no reprieves. It was basically a technical decision saying the way that these companies have been defined, you can't classify them that way.
They're not really a utility like the telephone. There's something else, and
the FCC had
much access to determining what can happen there.
Yeah, the FCC had not classified broadband providers as common carriers, mm-hmm. like what you would expect for telecom for phone companies.
Yeah,
and because of that, they were not bound by many of these rules that the FCC had done. Now, the out that the FCC has in this mm-hmm. is that they can go back and say, okay, broadband carriers are now common carriers. And now they're going to be subject to rules that we set up that the judge has basically put a roadmap in to say these are why it won't
work. Here's how to make it better, yeah.
And the FCC can then follow that roadmap and make regulations that follow that. Now, this isn't to say there isn't going to be some political wrangling having to do with this, because there are a lot of very well-moneyed interests that don't want the FCC to do this. So we'll see how this will work out. But so far, this is the state of affairs.
Okay. Now, has the FCC said anything about if they're going to follow the roadmap that the judge laid out for them? Or
I think it's too early to tell. I mean, this has only happened within the last week. So far be it from me to say that a government entity would work that quickly.
Okay, stay tuned. But it benefits us all just as people not to have some things slowed down and some things sped up, depending on the big moneyed companies that
The big fear that people have with regard to net neutrality, the dystopian view, know whether this would
Let's go straight to the major creep out.
Yeah, I don't know if this would actually come to pass, but the worst case scenario that people talk about are things like your internet connection ends up being like your cable service,
mm-hmm.
which is you pay this money and you get access to this swath of sites or this swath of channels.
Yeah.
And if you pay this money, then you get this package of channels.
Oh, great. We're going the cable route. Delightful.
And
everyone loves that about
cable. And, you know, there is some truth to that because, well, some of the biggest internet carriers are cable companies. So mm-hmm. it's not too much of a stretch to say they wouldn't try to go toward that model.
Yeah.
But that is also the dystopic view. That's the worst case scenario. And there are a lot of companies that have some deep pockets like Netflix that wouldn't necessarily want to be extorted by every ISP out there and may have some leverage.
Well, we'll see what happens. After that bit of dystopia, I could use a geek bit. You got something for me, Ben?
I got a geek bit.
I need to cheer up.
Yeah.
What
so
do you got?
About halfway through the show, usually we do geek bits, which are things that you want to see, not just hear. They're not great radio, which is why we have them up on our website. This is one of the coolest things I've seen in a while. And it's not necessarily because the video is super high resolution or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of what you're seeing. We now have for the first time recorded, we've observed a freshwater fish preying on a bird while it was flying.
While the bird was flying.
While the bird was flying, the fish jumped out of the water and ate the bird. And it was, it's just so crazy to think thinking about this from an evolutionary perspective, like, when did fish decide, oh, I know what I should do?
Oh.
Those things up above. I should just try eating one.
Yeah. All right. So that video is now up at our website, geekspeak.org. So if you're curious right now, in this moment, you can go and check that out. A fish eating a bird. It is a grainy video, but I remember when I saw it, I was like, what?
Yeah.
What? Everyone needs to watch out.
Yeah.
Oof. All right. Very good. And Miles, you've got a geek bit also, don't you?
Yes. A hardware modder has decided to try to make a replica of a Mac Pro, the recent cylindrical, high-powered desktop computer that Apple has released.
Oh, and yeah, it looks like a soda can.
So yeah, so he actually took a actual trash can, red trash can, and modded parts and made some custom parts and put a computer inside of it. So he has a. Instead of a Mac Pro, what people are calling a Trash Pro.
Nice.
And if you go to geekspeak.org, you should be able to see a picture of that because you just need to see it.
That's hilarious.
So cool.
Evolution of the Macintosh, which started 30 years ago. We'll be talking about that in a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But what were you going to say, Max?
And if I may, just a quick little announcement.
Yeah.
That a broad coalition of well-known organizations, including Reddit, the Electronic Freedom Foundation, Free Press, Mozilla, and others.
Mm-hmm. All cool announced, people.
This sounds important.
Announced recently that they will stage an online protest against wide-ranging government surveillance of internet users on February 11th in memory of internet activist Aaron Schwartz.
Oh, that's very sweet. So on February 11th, what do people do?
That's going to be up to the different companies.
Okay.
When things like this have happened in the past, many times people have turned their internet, their web pages to a black background.
Yeah, that was the SOPA one.
That was the SOPA protest, which was very effective.
Yes. Some have taken down their entire site and just put up a banner talking about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see, and it will be dependent upon those, but we'll see how this plays out.
Okay.
So if you have a term paper, did you say Wikimedia? Wikipedia? I'm just remembering the SOPA protest where everything was blacked out and all of Wikipedia was inaccessible for a day.
All people had to do any research.
Research people.
all the students who were told never to use Wikipedia as a research as a citation suddenly didn't have any citations.
Yeah. Mysteriously and coincidentally.
If you're smart, you don't use Wikipedia as a citation. You use the citation of Wikipedia as a citation,
which can get really messy.
Yeah, you look for the citation needed inside of Wikipedia. You look to see where the citation is, and then you use that. Mm-hmm. You don't actually use Wikipedia. You use the citations that are listed in Wikipedia.
Yeah, right, exactly, right. Exactly. There was a case, I can't remember the details of this, but there was a case where some political figure for some country that I don't remember, who had a really, really long name, mm-hmm. someone made a change to the Wikipedia page to add some silly word as one of his middle names.
Okay.
And then a news story actually copied his name from Wikipedia.
Wholesale.
And then the change was reverted at Wikipedia because someone was like, yeah, that's silly. That was not that's unsighted edit. And then the guy who made the edit went back and said, oh no, this news story, which copied it from Wikipedia, this news story says this is his name, so therefore that's his name.
Oh my gosh.
There was a full circle.
And around and around
and
we
around
go.
And around we go. My navel. Miles, it looks like you've got a geeky take on what may have to do with the shenanigans in New Jersey.
Yes. There have been all sorts of political, pros and cons of saying, oh, Governor Christie didn't know anything about the lane closings. It was a lower level staffer or a high level staffer in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a nice sound effect for the story.
warning.
But as it turns out, several traffic engineers, what's the term for urban engineers, have actually stated, we don't actually close lanes to test out when something is supposed to happen.
But, yeah.
We use simulation software.
So
we have a good idea of how
something's
going. Yeah, we take sensor readings of what traffic is like at any given time,
yeah,
and then we extrapolate through simulations to see what's going to happen. We don't actually close the lanes. So just for someone to say that we were doing that as a simulation or to test something out,
it's not accurate,
is
or at
bald
least
faced lie.
Oh, Aquardio. Oof. Boy, what is going on there in New Jersey? It does seem pretty mysterious, but there we go. It is not traffic studies. That is not what happened when there were 4 days of gnarly traffic.
So the geek take on political current events.
Okay, there we go. We're very topical here.
That was years and years ago. That was almost the first program I tried to write. Like, that wasn't a tutorial or in a class.
It was a traffic simulation.
I really wanted to make a traffic simulation because it's so interesting when you're driving, but you can only see from one perspective. You can't see the big picture.
And then you found out exactly how complex it is.
Yeah, I was thinking, just a car, you know, like it's cars are simple, you know, they just slow down when there are cars in front of them and they speed up when they're not. And I was wrong. No. I abandoned that project very quickly.
It's very complex.
Yeah. So all those folks that are doing traffic simulation software, mm-hmm, and who are using that, and engineers who have to work in that field, thank you so much. You have to work really hard and take a lot of math.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for your hard work. Let's see. What's going on in China, Ben?
Yeah, this news was met with a good amount of skepticism. China announced that it is creating its own operating system, which people were like, huh? Why would we want to use an operating system released by the Chinese government, given all of this stuff around that, you know, China has the...
Oh, I see. It's not just developers in China, but the Chinese government is...
Yeah, the Chinese government, I think, is like, you know, iOS, Android, those are all really pesky. We have to maintain our firewall. I mean, I don't actually know what their real...
Who knows what their
full motivations are. But yeah. So they released this operating system. Now, they actually did this before. Mm-hmm. In 2009, they released this thing, which it was Linux-based open mobile ecosystem that they tried to release in 2009. It fell totally flat. Everyone assumed it was discontinued in 2010, but it actually still technically is alive. It has 600 available applications. It's like this little sad thing.
Yeah.
So COS, China Operating System, the article says China is trying to take advantage of the recent NSA scandal in the United States to push its own product. And yet, a government-approved mobile operating system, especially in China, of all places, reeks of its own backdoor exploits for government spying.
Boy, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So it was just a really interesting thing. I mean, that's basically all I have to say about it. But
we have no idea, you know, how much the population in China, you know, swallows wholesale things like this, or if they decide to enforce
something like this. How much could they actually do that? What about people with iPhones, for example? You know, do they have to throw away their iPhones? Probably not. So.
Yeah.
Right. It's an interesting piece of news, and really more than anything, I'm just interested in seeing where it goes and seeing if it falls flat like the other one or if it goes somewhere.
Well, let's put a little pin in that and just mark it as something that we want to track and see what's going on with from time to time and what developments ensue.
If it takes off, you'll hear more about it here.
It's the beginning of a story right here on Geek Speak. Miles, Intel is challenging manufacturers. Why?
Yeah, this is a fairly quick one, but for the same reason that people look for conflict-free diamonds, mm-hmm, conflict-free gemstones, conflict-free, you know,
right, I call
insert
it
item.
Stuff you get at Trader Joe's, conflict produce, just
right,
it comes
not
from
wanting
the
to get materials that are funding and fostering wars, mm-hmm, in various countries and or creating conditions for things like slavery and.
Right.
Major forced migration,
civil rights issues,
like
and war and violence. Yeah. All right.
So Intel, the chip manufacturer, the CPU manufacturer, has made a call to the industry as a whole that they should avoid purchases of rare earth minerals and metals from conflict zones. In other words, to avoid conflict resources that we use to make chips. And electronics, batteries, things like that.
Right.
And Intel has pledged for themselves that they will lead that charge. And they're going to avoid that and actually have that as a marketing point.
Right. So they're going to market themselves around the fact that they don't use conflict metals. And the assumption is that that alone might encourage other manufacturers to follow suit.
Yeah, well, that's the hope, because Intel is the big 800-pound gorilla. So.
Okay. They're a major one. It's like if McDonald's decides to kill their cows in a more humane way, then it can be an industry standard.
Sure.
It's a weird analogy, but I made it. Somebody is the Temple Grandin of conflict metals. Okay. Ben, now I heard that we were just beginning to be allowed to make cell phone calls on planes.
Yeah, so the FCC is in the process of changing their stance on cell phone usage and electronic device usage and everything. And of course, this all came to a head for me when a couple of years ago, a flight attendant asked me to turn off my Kindle. And I thought to myself, gosh, my body probably uses more electricity than my Kindle does when it's not turning pages. So, and of course, the justification was always it's unsafe. The planes, you know, this and that might get this and that by whatever. Don't ask any questions, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Well, now the FCC is thinking, well, gosh, maybe people can make phone calls. Maybe people can text. Maybe people can just leave all their devices on all the time, potentially. So they're exploring that. And a lot of Americans wrote into the FCC. There was this explosion of fury around the idea of people being allowed to make voice calls. And this article has a number of quotes from people. Like someone says, for example, quote, "What's going to happen when mobile communications above 10,000 feet is allowed and John Smith receives a phone call mid-flight from his wife of 23 years, Jane Smith, announcing that she wants a divorce? Like, what's going to happen then on a plane?" Now, at the same time, we can make phone calls on buses. And, you know, if you're on a Greyhound bus, you're stuck in the bus for several hours. So
right.
Is it the same thing? Is it somehow fundamentally different? That's an interesting question that I've been kind of toying with in my brain. And another person concluded his lengthy comment with the word no, followed by the letter O 212 times. No.
Yeah. Well, luckily there are no concealed carry firearms even on planes in Florida.
Yeah.
So
at least that, right, yeah.
Because that is definitely a danger considering all the feedback.
The movie theater, yeah, okay.
That's
we don't
true.
Want another movie theater incident on a plane.
And do flight attendants also need the extra work of having to tell people constantly, quiet down, please, you know? Like,
yeah, really.
Because on a plane, typically you don't do all that much that requires vocalization unless you're a baby.
I have mixed feelings about it. Like, I think that if you, because it's going to be its own cell tower, the plane is, just say you get roaming charges and you have to pay extra for it, because that was the limiting factor for people using the in-flight phones,
right.
Was you had to pay $4
so
for
many
a simple
dollars.
Call. Yeah.
Yeah.
For a simple call. So if you do that and it shows, like, because your cell phone shows that you're roaming.
Right.
Maybe that will be a good enough disincentive that you can have it on and you can get that emergency call if you need it. But
so then
the
rich people can be obnoxious.
Exactly.
But how is that any different from how it is today?
Yeah, exactly. Yet another venue where that's allowed to happen.
I don't know. I mean, using those janky phones that look like they're from the 70s on the back of the seat. I don't know. Even if I had tons of disposable income, I don't know if I would actually make a call on those phones ever. Really, unless I
needed to make a phone call on it, because it was just like, there's a phone on the plane.
Yeah. So anyway, it's an interesting question. And
right, yeah. Where that'll land. I always vote for civility. I wonder if that'll actually rule the day.
My issue with it was not so much that we weren't allowed to do it. It was always that they would say, for safety reasons, da 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 da.
Yeah.
And that kind of ticked me
it's
off. Because no, it's not safety reasons at all. It's
right.
So anyway, we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, there we are. Stay tuned to see what happens on planes. You're listening to Geek Speak here on 88.9 KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch, and with me in the air room is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. We're about to take a break, and when we come back, it'll be a conversation with Apple employee number 12, Daniel Kottke, about next week's 30th anniversary celebration of the original Macintosh. Stay tuned. It is Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the air rooms, Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. By the way, Lyle Troxell is live updating GeekSpeak.org as we speak. Daniel Kottke is one of the developers of a computer that changed the way we interact with technology, the Macintosh. Kottke is co-producing a celebration of the computer's 30th anniversary next Saturday evening on the 25th at Flint Center in Cupertino, and he's with us on the line right now. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi, Bonnie.
How are you doing?
Thanks for getting my name pronounced correctly.
Oh, yes. Well, I, as a former music DJ, Kottke is a familiar name to those of us who like finger picking.
Oh, nice to hear.
Yeah. So tell us more about Mac 30th. What is this event?
Well, the main thing you would have to say at first is it was time for an Apple reunion. Mm. The last Apple employee reunion we had was 10 years ago. I was on the organizing committee for that one, and it was the first reunion that we held at the Computer History Museum.
Uh-huh.
I'm saying it was the first one that the Computer History Museum had done.
Ah, okay.
And it was a new event for them to consider, and everybody really had a great time. I think after 4 hours, it was over too soon.
Ah, yeah.
So, but of course, this is now the 30th anniversary of the launch of the Macintosh.
That's a nice round number.
And so, well, it was Gabe Franklin who had the bold idea to make this 30th anniversary event with tickets available to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
That did not sit well with a lot of people.
Oh, they wanted to have their reunion all by themselves.
Yes. I don't know.
Huh.
I don't know. People ask... I give a lot of interviews about the early Apple days.
Okay,
I just do it because it's not like I'm seeking the spotlight, but people call me up.
Yeah.
They want to talk about it.
So the thinking is that the Macintosh and Apple in general and the sort of early loyalty-generating days is something worth celebrating so that not just the people directly involved, but those who have a certain fondness for the computer can also participate.
Yes, of which there is a very large community.
Yeah.
We have yet to see how well the tickets will sell, but anyway.
Yeah, so it's happening on the 25th, next Saturday.
Yes.
At Flint Center. And what will be happening there?
Gabe Franklin, the main producer, is a videographer, and he has done an incredible job of gathering together rare, unseen bits of footage from the launch of the original Macintosh in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us old enough to remember that far back, there was a big Super Bowl commercial that was very controversial.
I do remember that, yeah.
That cost $1 million to run or something like that. It was the famous 1984 commercial.
And some of those folks who developed the commercial are going to be there at the event also, aren't they?
Yes. Ridley Scott, who directed the commercial, had originally sent his regrets because he was in the Far East on location.
Mm-hmm.
But I just heard yesterday he just may be there in person.
Ooh, that's an enticement.
Yes.
And what else will be happening?
Well, to the great surprise of many of us, Mike Markla is actually going to show up and present this Lifetime Achievement Award. Gabe's vision was to create a little, you know, a memento,
mm-hmm.
an actual physical award, and give it to all the members of the original team.
Mm-hmm.
That was about 120 people.
Mm-hmm.
Of those 120, we got in touch with maybe two-thirds of them. I'm not sure exactly. More than half will be there.
There's been an extensive attempt to reach as many people as possible, is what it looks like.
That was my part of the early work.
I see.
Starting back in November,
mm-hmm.
of contacting people. Fortunately, we have social networking now, which at least is encouraging. But, you know, now when you go to look up someone's phone number, it's always behind a paywall.
Yeah.
That's how times
have changed. Well, and what will you be doing the night of the event on the 25th?
I'm going to co-host the first panel. Our idea was we have three panel discussions.
Mm-hmm.
First is the conception, second is the birth, and third, the coming of age of the Macintosh. So, let's see. We recently got Bill Duvall to join the panel. Mm-hmm. He is the guy who wrote the editor, assembler, and linker and debugger for the development platform.
Okay, that's quite a bit.
Which actually wasn't even finished until 83. The project started, of course, in 1980, and then Steve Jobs took it over in early 81, but all the early code development had to be done on the Lisa.
Mm-hmm. the unreleased project.
Yes,
right?
That's right. Yeah, Lisa wasn't even released until January of 83, I think.
But it was still being used to develop the next big thing.
Yes.
That's
so anyway, so we've got the first panel, which is the conception, and so Bill Duvall and I think Larry Tesler is going to join us. Okay. He had worked on the Alto at Xerox PARC, which that was the forerunner machine that had the Windows mouse interface.
Okay.
Wasn't even for sale to the public.
Right.
But if Xerox had half an insight at the time, they could have owned the computer industry, it seems, from all the stuff they had at their
frequently stated.
Yeah, but you took it.
Well, they did. They commercialized the product. They released a commercial version called the Star. Mm-hmm. Star 8010,
I think.
And that was like 81 or 82. Mm. What was the price point on that? It was like a very nice car, right?
Yeah,
it was $40,000.
Computers were expensive at the time, but it was also very expensive even for
How much did a Mac go for originally?
Well, Jeff Raskin's original vision was $1,000. Not a penny more.
Yeah.
But of course, he got ousted from the project within the year. And I was so involved in the hardware thing. I don't know the debates that went on over the price on the marketing side, but the release price was $24.95.
Yeah.
Which was a lot of money back then.
Well, that's signature
worthy. That's a lot of money now.
That still counts as money.
Especially for a computer.
Especially for a toy computer.
A toy computer, right. I mean, I remember the Macintosh as being the first kind of like friendly computer. There's a little smiley face when I turned it on. And
mm-hmm. That was what we wanted.
That was the idea. And, something at that price point worthy of being signed. I understand that inside every Macintosh was a printing of all of the development team's signatures.
Yes, that was a great idea Steve Jobs had. Or, of course, I don't know. I don't know where he got that idea.
That he made happen.
We were all presented with a piece of foam core or a poster board, and we all signed it. Mm-hmm. And then that was etched into the mold that made the plastic.
That's pretty awesome.
It was pretty awesome.
It's like an Easter egg.
Yes.
Yeah, it is amazing how far we've come. There are a few Macintoshes in here are things that had that lineage.
Yeah.
And I think of the size of the screen on that original Macintosh, the original black and white, and as compared to what has happened after 30 years of evolution in the computer industry.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. Hey, Daniel, it's lovely reminiscing, and you're around in the world today. You're seeing what's happening. Are there any tech stories or tech developments that are happening out in the world now that tickle your fancy? What are you excited about these days?
Me personally, I am, I'm an embedded engineer, and I've dabbled in real estate investments in recent years, and that got me into the smart home market.
Okay, so.
And so I've got a bunch of smart home projects going on. And, anyone who pays attention to Kickstarter and Indiegogo, mm-hmm. there have been 24 wildly successful smart home projects in the past year. You know, door locks, power monitoring, lighting controls. I think they're all way overpriced. They're all proprietary and they're all overpriced.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yet, we're also in the era of Arduino and Raspberry Pi and open source hardware. And so that's all very exciting.
Yeah, each of which these little credit card computers have
yes.
an order of magnitude more power. If I mean, if not two orders, than the original Macintosh.
Yeah.
So crazy.
Also, I've been doing the math with 3% inflation from 1981 or 82 to 2013 dollars.
Say that again?
You said it was $40,000, right?
The Star.
Okay.
Star
was, yeah. So that computer in today's money would be over $100,000.
Ooh.
And if you think about the amount of money that Apple, that computers in general cost right now, I mean, that could be, you could say that's two orders of magnitude or even a little bit less. And then when you think about the processing power and the storage space and everything being orders of magnitude better, it's just mind-blowing how far we can come in 30 years.
And and yet the original Mac, even though it was floppy only, there wasn't a hard drive
in
there.
That's true, yeah.
it still reminds me of how far advanced that was as compared to the 60s and 70s, or the early 70s, I believe it was, where IBM had to load up a 5-megabyte hard drive into a cargo plane for transport with a forklift.
That's a great picture. Maybe we can find that and put it up on the GeekSpeak website too.
So Daniel, what was it like, given the advance that the Macintosh was? What was it like to program in those days at Apple?
The Macintosh was based on the 68000, which was a whole much bigger world in terms of programming than the 6502 that was in the Apple II. Mm-hmm. So I was an Apple II assembly programmer, but I never even got into assembly programming on the Macintosh. I thought I would. The good news is that the Mac came out with an entire toolkit of routines. So really, it was a whole development environment. Mm-hmm. Bill Atkinson was very, Andy Hertzfeld, Bruce Horn, those are the guys who created the toolkit.
Yeah.
And so it was a whole new paradigm for computing, graphical computing.
And
I never became a Mac developer.
Right. You were working on the prototype.
Yes.
And on the keyboard, right?
That's one of the things that I'm going to present in my first panel, in the first panel, because I was the guy who was bringing the prototypes to life, I saved all that stuff. I didn't throw it away when I left Apple. So I've got a set of all 10 versions of the circuit board.
Oh, wow. That'll be interesting to see sort of how they developed
It is very interesting to see how far it came. It's very rare that a product gets 3 years to gestate before it gets launched.
Right.
Now, I am a programmer, so I do have to ask, were you guys using source control?
I never heard of source control. I didn't even know what that is.
So that's a no, maybe?
There was no networking, and there was no flash drives.
That's true.
All we had was floppies.
So you just backed up to floppies and just copied it from place to place and just hope for the best.
Ship it around in pneumatic tubes within the company.
I have memories. Well, even right before the Mac project, it was the Apple III. That was the big product at Apple. And those developers, they were trying to bring Pascal, which is like C. They were trying to launch a Pascal development system. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how well that succeeded, but I remember
it succeeded quite well because in high school I studied Pascal on a Macintosh.
Okay, so it got you into programming.
Yeah,
right.
That was my introduction.
Yes, well, Jeff Raskin and Bill Atkinson both were involved in the UCSD Pascal project, UC San Diego. Mm. And I think that was the main reason we were following that path.
Right.
Anyway, I was going to say, I remember the Apple III developers, they would have stacks of four floppy drives, because each one was only 140K. Hard to believe.
Well, that's kind of adorable.
140K. Oh, my gosh.
Wow. Yeah. It must be just like spread and butter doing the same thing today.
Yeah, the official name, a single-density floppy drive.
There we go.
The ones that were actually floppy instead of the harder ones.
Yes, they were actually floppy.
So, Daniel, as we wrap up here, let's just go over once again what the event is that we're all riffing off of here. It is a 30th anniversary celebration of the Macintosh and an Apple employee reunion.
Yeah, well, that, I wanted to mention that, you know, the Flint Center lobby is not very big,
mm-hmm.
and it seats 2,200 people.
Okay.
So I was very concerned for where people can just mingle,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is what they want to do at a reunion.
Sure.
Hopefully the weather will be nice. Rains Cohen, co-founder.
I'm convinced it's never going to rain again, Daniel, so don't worry about
it. Well, that may be, yeah. Anyway,
Lyle's indicating
to mention,
that he really wants to go.
There is an unconference, meaning a free unconference, at the Student Union of De Anza all afternoon of the same day.
On the 25th?
On the 25th. Oh. And I did not find a page for it yesterday, mm-hmm. but... I guarantee you the Student Union will be filled with Macintosh aficionados
okay.
all afternoon.
So if you don't spot anybody, head over to the Student Union and see what you can find.
Yes, and we have that until 6 p.m. when the doors open at Flint Center.
Okay, so doors open at 6 o'clock at Flint Center. The event itself starts at 7 and goes till 10:30.
Very long event, yes.
But fascinating panels, lots of deep history. Stuff to see that people may not have seen before. And you can find out more at, is it mac30th.com?
Mac30th.com.
Mac30th.com. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.
And we'll have a link up on the website.
And we are doing that now, and that's at geekspeak.org. Thank you so much, Daniel Kottke. I really appreciate having you on the show, and goodbye.
Thank you, Bonnie. All right.
All right, ciao.
Hi.
This has been Geek Speak for January 18th, 2014. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at kusp.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit us at geekspeak.org. And thank you for listening.